including women and children, since 2008. Experts say the international community must end its apathy to Israeli crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A comprehensive cooperation roadmap aimed at expanding bilateral relations and 7 MOUs to boost trade and cooperation in transportation, agricultural, and cultural fields. The result of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko's two-day visit to Tehran, celebrating three decades of close ties between Iran and Belarus.
The visit can be considered a turning point in our bilateral relations. It's an opportunity to share our experiences. We have made remarkable progress despite the sanctions, and we have turned threats into opportunities. We are ready to share our experiences with our friend Belarus.
We're both on the same page. We both agree that a multipolar world is emerging. Iran has made great achievements despite Western sanctions and has turned into an important player in the region and the international arena. There's a lot that we can do together.
The high-level talks between the two sides also included a pledge to increase trade volume to $100 million per year.
Both countries are determined to improve their relations and trade. The economic relations between Iran and Belarus are not comparable to the past.
This is the third visit ever to Tehran by a Belarusian president and the first in 17 years.
Belarus and Iran enjoy strong relations, which is reflected in frequent high-level meetings and various agreements. Belarusian officials have described Iran as a strong partner for their country in the region and in the world. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
A leading critic of Israeli aggression against Palestinians, David Miller, who was sacked from his professorship at the University of Bristol in 2021 after a sustained campaign by Britain's Israel lobby targeting him, has addressed a group of Iranian students at the IRIB University in Tehran. He said Western spy agencies in association with the Western media outlets are to be blamed for unrests and riots in various countries, including Syria.
And MI6 also played a key role in the creation of the Free Syria Army and what was termed in British propaganda terms the moderate armed opposition in Syria. And the most shocking thing, I think, is the involvement in the managed massacre of captives in order to present evidence of chemical weapons attacks by the Syrian government.
Moreover, Miller said that the recent unrests, which erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime.
The hybrid war strategy against Iran, against so many other enemy states, is led by the United States via a myriad of assets and outlets. One of the key elements is what might be called the small media strategy. U.S. funds are channeled directly and indirectly to a variety of independent media and citizen journalism or media defense organizations.
Miller, who is also the producer of Palestine Declassified show on Press TV, has repeatedly come under attack by Israeli lobbies in the UK for supporting Palestine and revealing the true face of Israeli regime and its Western allies.
Although David Miller has been sacked from university and has been repeatedly pressured by Israeli lobbies, and there are efforts underway to undermine and smear his name and reputation, he believes such attacks will simply strengthen his resolve to continue the fight. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Creating a world where untold stories are told and unheard voices are heard. The annual IRIB World Service News Awards, dubbed SOAP Media Festival, this year had a lot to celebrate.
It's been a few years that the dynamics are changing and the new world order is emerging. The unipolar world is now turning into a multipolar world. Iran is in a position where it can speed up this process and offer a third viewpoint different from the two narratives that have always existed.
Words that clarify the mission of IRIB World Service. And this is exactly why the Arabic news channel Al Olam swept the IRIB World Service News Awards, taking home wins in nearly every major category, with its sister channel Al Olam Syria TV maintaining front-runner status with its popular talk show Zoom Room.
We are proud to be able to gain a strong foothold in Syria and West Asia in particular by shedding light on the truth and covering stories that are untold about people who have been misrepresented.
I've been with Al Alam for more than 8 years now. I have hosted many TV programs. It's great to be part of a team where the goal is to bring truth to light.
Meanwhile, the Spanish-language news channel Hispan TV, as well as Press TV, were seen as the gold standard of achievement in the television community, winning awards in different sections, including the Best Documentary and the Best News Website. Not to mention that Press TV's Palestine Declassified won the Best Political TV Show.
This is the moment we're in. We're in the end, the dying throes of US hegemony. And as he was saying, I very much agree with, the cultural infrastructure for the ending of hegemony has to be put in place, and that involves media, including news and journalism, which can give a different view on how the world is operating and tell more of the truth about the world. So, you know, the media play a central, important role in all that.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, who has covered the most difficult news stories, including the Rohingya crisis and the developments in Ukraine over the past year, was not left out.
I think two of my heroes, Noam Chomsky and John Pilger, said that they've never seen as much propaganda in the war in Ukraine than in any war that they've reported on or written about, and they've reported right back from Vietnam. So that's telling you a lot. And there's a huge amount of propaganda on Ukraine. Indeed, Ukraine is it's a civil war, but it's also a proxy war between Russia and NATO. And I think we're seeing the beginning of this split between the West and the East, China, Russia, Iran. And we're seeing a challenge to American hegemony and indeed the creation of this new multipolar world.
And according to the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB World Service is at the forefront of this propaganda war.
In this unequal war, where IRIB World Service has none of the advantages of mainstream media, from state-of-the-art technology to political support, it has been able to blaze a new trail. The fact that its news channels are frequently banned on different social media platforms is testimony to that. Meanwhile, this also proves in practice that the free flow of information and free speech are nothing more than slogans that are used as political tools by advocates of democracy.
Media play a key role in today's world. They can set the tone for diplomatic endeavors, and they are a tool of international communication. Particularly for the Islamic Republic of Iran, its media outlet can pave the way for diplomacy.
That is why there are great expectations, which means that so far, IRIB World Service has been able to deliver on its responsibilities.
In a world where mainstream media is setting the narrative, IRIB World Service has been able to break the monopoly and offer a new perspective. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
South Koreans opposed to upcoming joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises took their message to the presidential office. They worry the largest such drills in almost 5 years could lead to direct conflict.
Where did all the efforts for dialogue for each other go? We must stop the terrible threat that will actually lead to the devastation of nuclear war. We have to stop the battle without an exit. That's why we're here.
Last year, North Korea test launched a record number of ballistic missiles, with the U.S. and South Korea routinely conducting their own missile tests and smaller military drills.
The large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises had been suspended under previous President Moon Jae-in. But that's not the policy of current President Yoon Suk-yeol, who seeks to strengthen the alliance with the United States with the frequent deployment of U.S. nuclear-capable forces.
The drills are set to include both computer-simulated war games and field exercises. North Korea views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion.
Currently, the South Korea-U.S. joint military exercise is going ahead, generating aggressive tension, and includes a preemptive strike scenario. Wherever there is such a military exercise, tensions on the Korean Peninsula increase.
More large-scale drills with the U.S. are planned for this year, as President Yoon seeks to celebrate the 70th anniversary of South Korea's alliance with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A ribbon-cutting ceremony to go down in history, opening the production line of Iran's first homegrown jet trainer, Yasin. According to Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, the jet trainer is capable of carrying out combat missions as well as other tactical aerial warfare actions such as close air support or CAS, air-to-ground actions against hostile targets in close proximity of friendly forces.
Training good pilots is extremely important, and now with this homegrown jet trainer, we have technologically evolved significantly. This is considered a major step for our Air Force. The training period will now be shorter and more comprehensive.
Prior to this, jet pilot training was done outside Iran, and due to Western and U.S. sanctions, Iranian pilots could not receive training abroad.
We did ask for assistance, but no country in the world helped us. However, at the end of the day, it worked out for the best because we were able to develop the technology that we needed ourselves. Knowledge-based companies helped us a lot. In particular, I have to point out the design of the engine and also its aerodynamic design. All in all, Yasin is about 800 kilometers lighter than our first prototype, which is a significant achievement.
Iran started designing jet trainers over 10 years ago. Yasin is the second generation of a prototype that was unveiled in 2019. The new version now includes state-of-the-art avionics, engine, landing gear, and full cockpit devices.
With all the equipment installed, this training jet is fully equipped and it can be used for training pilots in all different levels.
But there's more to Yasin than just training fighter jet pilots.
It is also a question of prestige. This jet trainer was made by our own scientists and inventors. Knowledge-based companies played a very important part. Obviously, it means great economic benefits, but other than that, it shows that we can stand on our own feet. This is the most important message.
In the next 2 years, three more Yasin jet trainers will be produced based on the requirements of Iran's Air Force.
Iran has made great achievements in the field of aviation, and this is a symbol of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Despite the cold winter day, a huge turnout by thousands of NHS workers and their supporters calling for action in a dispute officially about inflation-matching pay, but really so much more than just that.
It's about the fighting for the heart of the NHS, because we feel this government is not committed to the principles of the NHS, which is a free, comprehensive service for all. They are privatising it by stealth, and they're hoping that it fails so that they then can do even more privatisation.
There are concerns about public safety when there are fewer workers available on strike days in a health service already at breaking point, which speaks of a deeper crisis.
Been depleted of funds, staff are leaving. NHS pay has been cut in real terms. And because of this, we're seeing staffing leaving. There's a staffing crisis. We cannot provide the care we want to give to our patients.
Similar action in recent months by nursing and ambulance unions seems to have forced the government to shift from its position on the amount of pay rises for this year, leading to some health unions to tentatively cancel strikes planned for this month. An 8-month strike wave that began last summer has seen industrial action across the public sector. Despite their impact, public support is still strong, especially for the NHS workers.
just a regular person that loves the NHS, and I think everyone in the UK loves them, and we don't want to see the NHS in crisis.
Next week, we'll see 3 days of strikes by junior doctors who have experienced a real terms pay cut of over 26% as the costs of food, energy, and rent soar.
The demonstrators here today say while they share the concern about the impact of strike action on patients, they have to do it to safeguard the health service before it's too late. Site Tourism, London.
Iran's Shahid Rudaki warship, an unlikely but definitely meaningful location to hold the closing ceremony of the 17th International Resistance Film Festival.
Now, in these days, you know that the films are more important even than the books. So it's very important for us to make people to know about our beliefs, also our artists and our filmmakers.
It helps us to give information through movies to our children about Islam, about Palestine, people, how they suffer. Someone just see a movie and starts crying after seeing what happens in Palestine, in Yemen, in Syria, through movies.
In these films, or what we're doing about drama and films, we want to give message. And our message to the Israel, that if you kill our people, we will speak about this.
In my opinion, resistance movies are mostly about war because they show that we have to fight to survive. We have to fight for our rights. And this is the most important message of resistance movies.
Making resistance movies is not just about sending a message, which of course is an important part of the whole issue, but everything about this genre is also a challenge. Consider the special effects, the computer graphics, the stunts, the cinematography in general. This genre turns a filmmaker into an expert.
2 kilometers away off the coast, the offshore closing ceremony on the blue waters of the Persian Gulf awarded the best resistance movies in several sections, including documentaries, animations, and short and feature-length movies. As expected, The Stranger, a movie directed by Mohammad Hossein Latifi that depicts the life of the IRGC commander Mohammad Burujerdi, swept most of the awards, while The Situation of Mahdi and The Mudroom came in next. But the success of an up-and-coming young female director definitely stole the show. Leyli Aj impressed the jury with her first movie, Colonel Soraya, a must-see, according to movie critics, that depicts the notorious terrorist group MKO.
The festival has been doing very well. So as a filmmaker, I feel proud that veteran filmmakers in the jury have found my film worthy of the Best Picture Award. Now this makes my job more difficult because expectations are high.
The main reason to produce films is to bring impact to people's lives, to bring change in people's lives. As a religious student, one of the best ways to preach is to produce films.
According to Major General Hossein Salami, the chief commander of the IRGC and the keynote speaker of the closing ceremony, the Resistance Film Festival has been able to do a great job in building cultural and artistic bridges between resistance filmmakers and therefore has become a powerful tool of cultural diplomacy with a promising future.
The 17th International Resistance Film Festival has come to an end in the most memorable way, with its participants hoping that they can use cinema to inspire people across the world and promote resistance against oppression. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Asaluye.
In the limelight. A
According to data collected by the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at American universities, hate crimes in the United States have increased during 2021-2022, and many major U.S. cities saw an increase in these types of crimes. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. A new report by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, says the frequency of hate crimes across the United States saw a record increase throughout 2021, especially those motivated by bias against black people. The FBI said on Monday, 13th of March, that more than 10,000 instances of hate crimes were reported during that year, reflecting an 11.6% overall increase. The percentage reflected a 31% increase from 8,263 cases the previous year, while the year-on-year increase in hate crimes was the largest in more than three decades. The report added that 64.5% of victims in 2021 were targeted because of their race, ethnicity, or ancestry bias. It also noted that racist incidents targeting black people comprised the largest number of the incidents, namely some 2,233 cases. A separate analysis showed that anti-black crimes were followed in frequency by crimes committed against white people, 948 cases, Jewish people, 817 cases, and people of Asian origin, 746 cases. The agency also recorded 152 hate crimes targeting Muslims, with a total of 190 victims, which added up to about 1 in every 20,000 Muslims. The FBI's new analysis marks the first time the Bureau has been confidently reporting national hate crime trends since it transitioned to a new data collection system. Of course, uniform crime data released by the FBI in October of 2022 contained gaps because only 52% of U.S. law enforcement agencies reported full 12-month information relating to 2021. The agency said in a news release, of the 8,327 hate crime offenses classified as crimes against persons in the updated 2021 data set, 43.2% were intimidation, 35.5% were simple assault, and 20.1% were aggravated assault. FBI officials said they typically track the 130 most populous cities across 16 states to identify statistically significant trends. Of those, 96 cities were able to provide data for the new report. The nation's two largest cities, New York and Los Angeles, are now included in the hate crime analysis reported on Monday, 13th of March, while Chicago was able to provide two quarters worth of data for the report. Jonathan Greenblatt, chief executive of the Anti-Defamation League, says the report confirms that hate crimes in the United States reached record high levels in 2021. The English website of Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. The Muslim and black population of the United States has increasingly been the target of Islamophobia and hate crimes in recent years, which unleashed a new era of racism and discrimination against Muslims and black people. The executive director of the Los Angeles chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Hossam Ailouche, said that Muslims and blacks continue to face the threat of targeted violence. Ailouche added, they continue to be the target of hate, bullying, and discrimination as a result of the stereotypes that were perpetuated by Islamophobes, white supremacists, and the media in recent years. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes against Muslims skyrocketed immediately after the suspicious attacks of 11th of September 2001 and are still on an upward trend. Adu said, "The unfortunate reality is there are people and organizations that benefit from perpetuating Islamophobia, bigotry and war." Erush noted that after the 9/11 attacks, there was a perfect storm of the American people and its government needing a common enemy. The multi-million dollar Islamophobia industry, the military-industrial complex and the growing threat of white nationalism. He added, these factors combined created a volatile environment for Muslims and anyone else perceived as the other. The unfortunate reality is that there are people and organizations that benefit from perpetuating Islamophobia, bigotry and war. Hossam Elouch further said that the statistics were not surprising considering the current volatile political climate in the United States perpetuated by former President Donald Trump during his term in office. Elouch added, Trump's presidency normalized being an anti-Muslim bigot. He made it socially acceptable to be overtly anti-Muslim and racist. According to Zahra Jamal, Associate Director of Rice University's Boniuk Institute for Religious Tolerance in Houston, Texas, 62% of Muslims report feeling religion-based hostility, and 45% of blacks feel disrespected by white supremacists. The website of Open Access Government has also covered the same story. Hate crimes in the United States have increased in frequency in recent years. However, legislation protecting victims across many states is limited. Hate crimes are generally defined as a crime often involving violence that is motivated by prejudice based on ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, or similar grounds. Legislation against these crimes is vital to reduce racism, extremism, and fascism against particular groups of people, as they are acts of violence or hostility directed at people because of who they are. Across the United States, numerous states have witnessed the rise of white supremacy and religious extremism, prompting the federal government to pass legislation targeted at crimes motivated by hate. However, research conducted to understand the nature of these laws across 50 states found the nation's hate crime legislation lacked definition and inclusivity of specific crimes, and some states did not have any legislation protecting victims at all. Researchers from Florida Atlantic University gathered data analysis consisting of 271 statutes looking at four themes that emerged from the data: how hate crimes have been contextualized, inconsistencies in hate crime legislation coverage, differences in court procedures in hate crime cases, and state efforts to combat hate crimes. Indiana, Mississippi, New Hampshire, and South Carolina were found to have no statutes at all, with no protection from crimes against religion, race, disability, and more. Although voting and political expression are paramount in a democracy, only Iowa and West Virginia had statutes that recognized hate crimes motivated by political affiliation. There were 37 states that protected religious locations. However, most states do not mention mosques among protected institutions, despite these religious institutions being the most frequent targets of hate crimes. While churches were the most identified religious institution among hate crime legislation, they were mentioned by name in fewer than half of U.S. states. The only state that protects all places of worship was Delaware.
From east to west. about the vast land of Iran. You're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Not an increase, but getting back what has been lost. That is what some striking doctors in Britain are saying for the reason they are protesting. On Monday, 40,000 junior doctors started a three-day walkout, demonstrating against their salaries and overall work conditions. Now, these doctors followed others from various professions protesting their job conditions. In a very un-English move, teachers to postal workers to public transport staff and beyond, Brits have waged industrial strikes. Now, the British are not like the French, who are known for protesting. So when the Brits take to the streets en masse, things must really be bad. Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program out of London. Bob Gill, NHS campaigner. And Shabir Rezvi, economic and political analyst, also out of London. Thank you both for being with us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's start this off with Bob. These industrial actions started actually last year by railroad industrial employees, and we've seen strikes spread throughout various sectors of the society, and now the doctors have joined in. I mean, your perspective in general, why are we seeing the amount of these actions, and why now that we're seeing in a society that usually really is not big into in-mass strikes?
Thank you. Yes. So I think the background is more than a decade of austerity following the 2008 financial crash. The public sector has witnessed a suppression of wage growth such that health workers have experienced up to a quarter of their income lost in real terms. So a doctor working 10 years ago was earning 25% more than a doctor equivalent now. So on top of that, we've had 3 years of pandemic and most recently a cost of living crisis with rising inflation, rising rents and rising energy costs. So a combination of factors has led doctors and other health staff to say enough is enough and we want a restoration of our pay so we can, you know, cope with the cost of living. So it's taken a lot to push people who, as you describe, are generally quite tolerant and passive, for them to not only strike, but vote for strike action with an overwhelming majority. So there was up to 90% of doctors voted for industrial action. Now, that's quite some mandate for the unions to act. Hmm.
Wow, up to 90%. I mean, Shabir, what does it mean when we're talking about 40,000 junior doctors walking out for 3 days? What does it mean for the patients, for the whole medical situation there? And what does it mean for them? It just seems like such an act of desperation.
Hello, Asia. It's lovely to be back.
Nice to have you.
Program. Look, the situation, as our colleague from the NHS described, that the tragedy is that it's particularly the medical profession, the junior doctors, who in UK work between 70 to 80 hours a week. They're on long shifts, they do unpaid overtime, and the pay that they earn for having gone to university and studied for 5 years plus, by the time they're 25, 26 years old, they're probably earning only about £35,000, if you like, which is not a huge amount when you think, as I said, the amount of hours that they have to put. Alcoholism is very high. Sort of mental well-being is another sort of challenge that junior doctors face. And the other sort of interesting aspect is that a lot of junior doctors, after qualifying, really go off to Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, or the Middle East, or West Asia in the Gulf countries, where they can earn more money. So the reality is that the health profession, particularly the junior doctors, have been pushed in a corner, and they had to take this action, as our colleague has quite rightly pointed out. It's not just in real terms that their incomes have been reduced significantly, but the reality is that inflation is very high in the UK, and as you know, last year, industrial action was a defining moment in 2022, and with no signs of letting up in 2023. We are in the first quarter of this year, and tomorrow, our Chancellor, the Finance Minister, will be announcing his new budget, and many industries will not be working tomorrow on budget day, whether it's doctors, teachers, university lecturers, and rail workers. So 15th, tomorrow, is going to be a big day, not only for the fiscal measures government may be announcing, but also for the sort of industrial action by the workers.
Well, Bob, Shabir said tomorrow is going to be a big day. Are you expecting perhaps the government to give in somewhat? I mean, in general, why have we seen the government not being responsive to the needs, it seems, of the not only the doctors, but so many other people in various professions when they're so much under pressure?
Well, I think the underlying ideology of this government and successive governments has been that of neoliberalism. What they want to do is privatize public services, and in order to make the public services attractive to private corporations, part of that is wage suppression. So they have done the dirty work on behalf of largely multinational corporations who are moving into the NHS, and they want a very lowly paid and compliant workforce. So our government has been doing the dirty work on behalf of American multinationals, insurance companies, and provider chains. Their healthcare industry is coming in and encroaching and due to take over the NHS. But the other factor that is really demoralizing the medical profession is that they can no longer work in a safe environment. We have an NHS that has 40,000 nurse vacancies, at least 10,000 doctor vacancies. We have overstretched A&E departments. We have in excess of 500 excess deaths per week. So the NHS is on its knees. If the government does not satisfy these pay demands, then you're going to carry on seeing the exodus that your other guest has mentioned, exodus out of medicine or out of the country, making the situation worse. And ultimately, in the long term, that is a tragedy for patient care in this country.
Well, Shabir, I mean, if that is the case, what Bob has said, why isn't it more of a priority for the UK government. What the government is saying is that it simply cannot afford to give the doctors and others what they are demanding, and it would add to the double-digit inflation. Your thoughts on this?
Well, look, the government keeps on talking about that there's no money. Famously, Theresa May, who was our prime minister some years ago, said that there is no money tree when it comes to sort of paying low-paid workers or compensating the doctors in a proper way and the nurses so that they can manage cost of living crisis, inflation, and all those. But when money is required for Ukraine, money is found from somewhere immediately, and billions have been sent there. Secondly, if money is required to bail out the banks, as it was done in 2008, is found. And currently, with the sort of Silicon Valley bank debacle taking place in the USA, again, bailout is taking place in the USA, and here also the branch of Silicon Valley Bank has been rescued by HSBC. So it's interesting, as our colleague said, that this government for the last 13 years that it has been in power has applied austerity measures in such a vicious manner that it's really making the people feel the pain of living and managing themselves effectively in the United Kingdom. Secondly, what they have done, they have applied, as quite rightly pointed out, the neoliberal economic model where the so-called entrepreneurs are given all the opportunities and profits are privatized and bailouts are sort of, become part of the social fabric where the taxpayer has to pay them. So that's the reality of this government's ideological drive by which they are sort of trying to bludgeon the working people in the United Kingdom so that they don't make much noise. And when privatization takes place, they will feel that, oh, at least we have got a job. And that's what I think is the real battle that is taking place here in UK at this moment.
Well, Bob, you mentioned about neoliberalism earlier. I mean, is this what we're seeing, basically the implosion of this neoliberal agenda? On the one hand, they want to make more profits. On the other hand, they can only pressure the people so much to their some blowback. I mean, your assessment of this at this point in time there?
Well, I wish the neoliberal project would implode. What we've seen is massive wealth transfer to the super rich. We have socialism for corporations, and you have hard, extreme capitalism for everybody else. So, what these companies are doing, they want to draw profits out of the state. They want to draw profits, guaranteed profits, out of the tax base. And that's what our governments have been enabling. So, if you transfer the whole tax base and hand this over to private corporations to skim away profit for their shareholders and CEOs, our governments, successive governments over decades, have been quite happy to allow this to happen. So we're having a sort of cannibalization of the state. And, we've deindustrialized. We've become very heavily financialized. We're relying on the bank, bloated and deregulated banking sector, which showed how dangerous that strategy was in 2008 when the banks crashed. But no lessons have been learned. And it seems like we're on the precipice, perhaps, of another crash. And who will pay the price? The ordinary member of the public, and they will pay that through inflation. They will pay that through asset price rises and the decimation of the public services.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Shabir, I mean, what does it all mean? Because we're looking at the UK. We know that it has basically given billions in dealing with the Ukraine war with Russia. On the one hand, it finds money for an external goal. On the other hand, its people are basically begging for crumbs, practically. But it just turns its head the other direction. I mean, your overall assessment, what does it mean? So does it mean that this government actually is just for a certain selection of the people, the 1%? Or what is it exactly going on here?
Well, not only in the United Kingdom that the government do the bidding of the 1%, whether it's a conservative government that has been in power or potentially the Labour Party who are expected to win the election when it's held, they both are really not much different anymore. And they all do the bidding for the 1%. But what the important and interesting aspect of all this is that the 99% of the population that do have the power on the street somehow are being muzzled, somehow are being sort of hoodwinked into believing that, tomorrow would be better. You know, politicians come and promise them change, but really no change occurs. And then what happens is that the ordinary people foot the bill all the time. But I'm really hopeful that what is happening globally at this moment and the Ukraine crisis is really just the tip of the iceberg of what is really happening, not in only in UK, but across Europe and across the pond in the US, is that the ordinary people will realize the power that they have amongst themselves to be able to get their rights. And you know, ordinary people are not asking for Lamborghinis and Gucci watches and Prada bags. What they're really asking for is bread on their table, keep their houses warm, and so that, you know, when they're ill, they can be looked after in a dignified manner. That's what they're asking. The rich and wealthy may want to buy 10 Prada bags and 10 Gucci watches and have a whole host of, expensive cars in their houses. But the reality is that ordinary people do not want too many things. They just want simple, ordinary, comfortable life with dignity.
Well, with that being said, Bob, because Shabir talked about this change or this perspective, what is happening that people, despite being under pressure, whether we're talking about the UK or US or some other countries, Western countries, despite being under pressure, they still believe that this change, this positive change is on the horizon and things are going to be better tomorrow, when the reality, if we look at the numbers, is that is not exactly the case, especially if things continue on the same path that they've been going?
I think the biggest problem is with our media. Nobody's explaining this to them. As Shabir pointed out, we have political parties that you can hardly tell any difference from, so these arguments are not being made. And at the same time, we're being distracted with external enemies. Supposedly Russia's our external enemy and China's our next external enemy. And we have all this scapegoating of immigrants and minorities. So the public are distracted. They're divided on cultural issues and they're kept in the dark about what the real political agenda is. So, you know, the chances of me getting onto mainstream British broadcaster are next to zero, because they do not want my message to get out there. So social media and other platforms are the only way to do this. But we do not live in an open democracy. We do not have a free and fair press, and we do not have impartial broadcasters. We have a very controlled, propagandized nation, which is, you know, hoodwinked and indoctrinated to divide and rule between themselves, and also always fear some external enemy, whereas the biggest enemy to prosperity in this country is our own government.
Well, Shabir, how likely is it that with the reality that is taking place on the ground, that we will see more of a radicalization of the public? As I said in the beginning, I mean, the Brits are not really known for taking to the streets, but are they getting more like those across the channel and the French? I mean, it appears that people can only take so much pressure. Do you see a future radicalization of the public or no? Will they just continue to acquiesce?
Look, I think at the super point made by our other guest is that it's the media, it's the sort of the chattering classes who do the bidding of the ruling elite, the 1%. And that sort of digresses the ordinary people from really understanding who the enemy is. And obviously the cultural wars are another digression, whether it's LGBT issues or whether it's gender issue or whether, you know, all kinds of host of issues which really don't have an impact on people's life. But we keep on continuing on that debate and really not challenge the ruling elite for what they're sort of inflicting on ordinary people. I mean, your sort of view that across the channel in France and Italy, people have demonstrations. But, you know, the UK population sometimes is regarded as a bit docile as to coming out on the streets. But they do come out on the streets when it's required. Just to remind your viewers that, you know, 2003, when Iraq was going to be attacked by the NATO forces, Britain and the USA, over a million people came out on the streets. Yes, no one heard their voice, but people did come out on the streets. And then during, you know, just before Margaret Thatcher got elected in the late 70s, we had a winter of discontent where there were demonstrations. We had a three-day week in the United Kingdom over 40 years ago, which sounds a long time ago, but we had those kinds of situations. And then again, to get rid of Margaret Thatcher's poll tax in the United Kingdom, people demonstrated in huge numbers, and then she had to sort of actually change that policy. So Britain sometimes may not come out as quickly as the European counterparts, but when they do come out, it does have an impact. And I think that's what needs to happen, that more mm-hmm. people should come out on the streets to challenge the government and its policies.
So with that being said, Bob, do you think that people coming out on the street is really having an impact if these industrial strikes, industrial actions continue? Can it have an impact, or will it be, just like Shabir said, back in 2003, a million people took to the streets and were against the Iraq war, but at the end of the day, it didn't really change the reality?
I think it can have an impact, but the forces who are genuinely fighting what's going on in this country need to come together. We have unions within the health union who are calling for strike action on different days. Well, that makes no sense whatsoever. We need coordinated industrial action. We need progressive forces on the left to unite and provide some leadership. We don't have that at the moment. We have a vacuum. So if our side can get organized and coordinated, then we have every chance, particularly if the junior doctors have a successful industrial action. Well, that will put the government on the back foot. We need some sort of